Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, a show where we catch you up on the political news of last week and preview Ohio's week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me at the roundtable this week is Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Good morning.
Jesse Ballmer, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Hi, Jesse.
Hi, happy Monday to all.
And Julie Carsmyth, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Good to see you.
Happy to be here.
So Ohio has a new member of Congress. Republican State Senator Michael Rulli heads to D.C. after winning last week's special election. Now, Rulli's victory didn't come as a surprise. The 6th District is solidly Republican, and Rulli outspent his Democratic opponent by about 100-1. But, Julie, why are Democrats framing this special election as a bit of a shocker?
Well, Rulli did not win the district by the percentage that might have been expected, given the just the Republican index, we call it, of that district. And he won. But for example, his predecessor, Bill Johnson, whose seat he's filling, used to win this district by 30 plus points, and Rulli won by something just under 10. Donald Trump similarly won the district by 30%. So, or 30 percentage points. And so you look at Mahoning County particularly, which we watch carefully in this state because it's been sort of a...
It used to be Democrat. Now it seems like it's Republican.
Right. It seems like it's our bellwether county in a weird way. At least in early returns, his opponent, Michael Kripchak, had won that county by 14 votes. Not a lot or anything like
very
that.
Very narrow margin.
And it could be that that flips. But, you know, I talked to the Mahoning County Republican chair, and you know, he wasn't unconcerned about that. I mean, you know, they had hoped to win all the counties in the district. And so it's an interesting thing where the Democrats are saying, listen, if turnout remains low, which it was exceptionally low in that, maybe this is a sign that there is a hope for certain Democratic Congress people in the fall. I'm certain
Democrats named Sherrod Brown.
Right. And I'm certain that it's not going to flip Ohio for Joe Biden or anything that dramatic. But Sherrod needs to win by, I mean, he obviously just barely needs to win, but there's a question of, you know, could he win by more?
So, Laura, Mahoning County that we've been talking about used to be part of the district of Democrat Tim Ryan, mm-hmm. but it hasn't gone for a Democrat since 2020. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess it may have very narrowly gone for Kripchak, but like, it was a really low turnout election. So how much should we be reading the tea leaves?
Well, when you look at the national level, Democrats are saying that in all special elections recently, they've either won when polls said that they shouldn't have, or they've only lost by small amounts when polling showed that they were going to lose by more. So I think Democrats are counting on abortion continuing to be a salient issue. This turnout, I think, was, 7.5% for the one on Tuesday. I was reading some analysis by David Skolnick. He's, like, definitely the reporter from the paper in Warren, and he's been a longtime reporter there. And he said that Rulli barely campaigned, that most of the campaigning happened in the Republican primary. And although his family owns a grocery store called Rulli, and so his name's like known.
Well known, yeah.
Yeah. That district is the strip of counties that falls along the Ohio River. So I think, what, 7?
Yeah, 11. It goes 11. From like Mahoning County and Youngstown all the way down to
Marietta, I think.
Yeah. It also includes East Palestine mm-hmm. as well. So,
and for some people, because the more socially conservative Republican lost the primary, some people, some Republicans were believed to not be super motivated to vote for Rulli. But then other people think Rulli's like a gun toter because he and his wife live like in the woods. And there have been instances of people kind of either trespassing or not quite knowing where the property line is, and they're hunting. And then they've got Michael Rulli and his wife have shot at people, firing warning shots. And so then some people think they're gun crazy and didn't want to vote for them. And those probably All those things also probably factored in.
So,
yeah, I think the turnout was
7.5%. Yeah, that's not a lot.
It's something we're all watching, right? I mean, because the enthusiasm is felt to be very low, even just in all of our daily lives. If you wander about, it's like, well, you know, this presidential race is a rematch, and I'm turned off by politics, and the world is imploding, and why should I care? And, you know, so the turnout is also being closely watched, I think.
Really was never endorsed by Trump, as far as I know. He was a Trump delegate for president, so he ran on that, but Trump didn't get involved in this one.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And this is just kind of a really interesting district, like you said. Part of it used to be Tim Ryan's, which was a Democratic district for a bit. Part of it is the original six, which used to stretch even further down the state. It's just a really massive district with 11 different counties, a lot of which are not very heavily populated. And so trying to get a message across that entire stretch is just really challenging. And
Multiple
media markets, and this is a weird summertime special election. So if you're a Democrat looking for hope, certainly there are signs that you can feel good about, especially after last year with the abortion measure, like Laura mentioned, and the August election. But if you're a Republican thinking this is going to be a safe bet for fall, I think you're fine with that, too.
Yeah.
Well, and I heard, similar to what Laura said, that my reporting was that he didn't campaign very much, and that there, you know, even the Republican chairman kind of said we might have taken that for granted. I mean, it's a every district in the state is pretty well gerrymandered for one party or the other, and that's the way our map is. This is a unconstitutional map that we're working under, favoring Republicans, but the lawsuits were all dropped with the idea that let's just end the madness and wait for the next cycle.
Speaking of redistricting, Jesse, former Supreme Court Justice Maureen O'Connor was actually out campaigning in this district ahead of Election Day. What was she doing in the 6th?
Yeah, so her and the organization that she's working with, called Citizens Not Politicians, which is working on a ballot initiative that would replace the current way we do redistricting with a citizen panel of individuals. So they were out just kind of pointing out how large this district is, how kind of weird and wonky in some places it is. There's one instance where a house is surrounded on three sides by people who are in a different district, like a very small town that has an apple festival is divided into two congressional districts. And so part of map making is making decisions. The lines have to go somewhere. They're going to be awkward at some point, but, you know, is this the best way to draw this district? And that's certainly something that she's trying to get out. They were also trying to collect more signatures. The deadline to submit those signatures is July 3rd. And so I think they feel confident that they're going to make the ballot, but more signatures always helps with that.
And speaking of campaigning, Politico reported that former President Donald Trump will campaign to defeat Senator Sherrod Brown. I don't think that's surprising to anyone, but it does mean we may see him here in Ohio this year.
Yes. I mean, I don't think that this is a surprise. He has endorsed Bernie Moreno, who's the Republican running against Sherrod Brown. And, you know, he'll probably want to be here anyway, to just to show, you know, he cares about the state, even though he's won it quite nicely by 9 percentage points. But he is also struggling with his own issues and what is going to happen with middle of the road. We have about a third of our voters who are independent, and, you know, what happens with the fact that he's been convicted and other things going on in the presidential race that might make it beneficial for him to show up and send his message.
But I'm not sure if current President Joe Biden will show up to campaign for Sherrod Brown. I'm not sure Sherrod would want that right now.
Yeah, I think that there seems to be some, this is where I'm different from him. One example I read, I can't remember where it was, maybe the New York Times, but there's a lot of pressure around Biden to blame inflation on corporations that are seeing record profits, but still find the need to charge more and sometimes do shrinkflation for smaller products. And Sherrod Brown has for a while now been calling out these companies like there isn't, you know, inflation, there's company gouging. And Biden isn't quite ready to say the same thing, but he has campaign advisors who are like, do what Sherrod Brown's doing. So
So we'll have to wait and see. But I want to shift our conversation to the State House. So lawmakers are trying to get a bunch of bills passed to the governor before they head home for summer break, including a multi-billion dollar spending package filled with money for local construction projects. Jesse, are we going to get a capital budget this week?
I don't think this week, but I think next week is the plan.
Yeah.
So last week, the Senate introduced their list of items, about $350 million for local projects. This is state money that is kind of freed up because of all of the federal money that we got during the COVID-19 pandemic. And so this is money that they had always kind of set aside for one-time projects. They include things like there's a Columbus like connector loop that they want to do. Cincinnati is getting a large amount of money for the convention center project. The Cincinnati Open, the tennis tournament that was potentially going to go to another state, is getting a decent amount of money. Projects up and down, you know, Ohio for these organizations. So that's one chunk of the money. And then there's also like the underlying capital budget, which will include things like jails and schools and also this list of community projects. So
even
more
like
money for local people.
Stuff, right? Yeah.
So this is a very large spending package. I think the speaker said maybe even close to like $4 billion. And so that's a lot to agree on, but I think lawmakers certainly enjoy giving money back to the locals right before an election.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. It sounds like they want to pass it by like June 26th and then go on break until September-ish. That's right. Kind of the plan.
This Wednesday is a state holiday, so they're not meeting.
Right.
Juneteenth, yeah.
But next Wednesday is probably when we're going to see movement. Julie, let's talk about some of the things they did pass last week. So House Republicans and Democrats overwhelmingly voted to require certain employers in Ohio to use the federal E-Verify system, which is a way of verifying that your workers are legal to work here in the United States. You know, it's an election year, and I sort of wonder whether the large bipartisan support for this bill had something to do with that.
Right. I mean, we are seeing I guess citizenship and immigration as the one of the hugest issues of the whole year. And we're watching legislatures here and elsewhere getting into areas where they can find some common ground and areas where they're very much divided to try to assure people out there that their party and they are working to keep this system in place, I guess. I mean, and what we saw earlier was that they had a bill to ban foreign nationals, for example, contributing to ballot issues and things like that. And so it's been shown, particularly among Republicans, to be the top issue. And I think for Democrats, it's maybe the second.
Yeah. This one would require any employer with like 75 or more employees to sign on to the federal E-Verify system. The Ohio Contractors Association at this point is not on board because it does exempt residential construction companies. And so at this point, they're trying to get, they want it to be more fair is what they're saying. So it's still passed, they passed the Senate or the House?
The House.
Okay, yeah. Passed the House. So it's still got some ways to go.
Yeah.
And one more thing, just to get kind of that Democratic perspective, Representative Lauren McNally from Youngstown area Democrat was saying that this program could help to the workers to not be taken advantage of by, you know, unscrupulous employers who might be using their immigration status against them as some sort of
cudgel,
blackmail kind of situation. And so I think that's how you get Democrats on board with something like this that might otherwise have been a divisive issue.
Yeah, we'll be talking about the politics of immigration at 11. But it's also worth noting that U.S. Senator J.D. Vance is backing a federal effort to mandate E-Verify nationwide. So I guess Republicans at all levels essentially are.
Yes, and like I say, this is a big point that they're trying to elevate for the purposes of the presidential election, because Republicans are going to come at Joe Biden and say that he has, you know, created chaos at the border. And there's been a lot of, you know, false narratives as well as far as some of the dangers. I think that the ads I've seen that Trump is running are very much like, you need to live in fear. our nation is fearfully and scarily sort of vulnerable, and it's Joe Biden's fault. So voters are going to see a lot of that sort of narrative headed in, and that's why they're, I think, trying to, whatever bills relate to immigration, they're trying to
pass and pass quickly.
Yes.
That was Julie Carr-Smith, a government reporter for the Associated Press. Coming up, an update on the voucher lawsuit and why state lawmakers want to declare open season on feral hogs. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smith, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. So let's go back to 2018, and Governor Mike DeWine is running for governor. And, you know, we've had a lot of questions about what the governor knew when in relation to the first energy scandal. That's the nuclear bailout that ensnared former House Speaker Larry Householder, resulted in him spending the next couple of decades in federal prison. So there's been a lot of questions about what Mike DeWine knew when, how in contact he was with First Energy, how actively he was courting not only their support, but their money. So, Jesse, Cleveland.com has a new story out where it's 2018 and Mike DeWine texts Chuck Dowling, the CEO of First Energy, and says, "Chuck, can you call me?"
Yeah, I guess first off, great reporting by Jake Zuckerman over at Cleveland.com. We've received a number of records, and by a number, I mean thousands, tens of thousands of records from the Ohio Consumers Council and the Public Utilities Commission in relation to a public records request. There's like a lot of different lawsuits and records that are being pulled up because of this whole scandal. And so this particular exchange was in October of 2018. The governor texts Chuck Jones, the former CEO of First Energy, saying, you know, can you call me? Also makes a reference to a large donation that DeWine's competitor, Democrat Rich Cordray, had received from the Ohio Education Association. And so the implication of this is we need some cash for the campaign. And I would say,
because it wasn't clear at the time that DeWine was going to win, right?
Correct. A lot of the polling at the time was very, very close. DeWine ended up winning by like 4 or 5 percentage points, which was a little safer than anyone kind of anticipated at the time. Also bringing you back to 2018, that was shortly after Donald Trump had won and Democrats were having a blue wave in other parts of the country. And so there was a real expectation that Democrats would have a great year in 2018 in Ohio. That ultimately did not end up being the case. And Mike DeWine won that race. But so there was a need for money. There was shortly after this text exchange, there was about $500,000 that was given to the Republican Governors Association's like dark money affiliated group. It's called State Solutions. A lot of people have previously reported that about $2.5 million from State Solutions went to back DeWine's governor bid.
So, Laura, that's a little so. I thought he's not supposed to coordinate with those kinds of groups. So how does this Chuck, can you call me, fit into this? It's so hard to say.
I'm dying here. Rich Cordray is getting more money than me. And then we don't know what happened on that phone call. Maybe
Because they weren't recording at that point. The FBI hadn't stepped in and started recording things.
We don't know, but we do know that the next text said something between Dowling and Jones, said something like, 500K sent over here. It's been handled. And so I think that, you know, it's not illegal or anything for the governor to ask for synergy or to you know, solicit them for campaign donations. But the timing is very odd, and the intimacy here when, you know, what happens next in history is that he does win the election in that November. By that December, a guy named Sam Randazzo is pulled away from retirement and nominated to be on the PUCO, which was one of First Energy's big wishes.
That's the board that oversees utility companies.
Right. And then he proceeds to help write HB6, which then Larry Householder shoves through the House. So
and ultimately lands him in prison.
Right. And when we have interviewed DeWine before, you know, we years ago learned that there had been this dossier that was presented to his chief of staff from fellow Republicans saying it's very dangerous to hire Sam in this position. You know, DeWine would say, I never read the dossier, but I'm the one, the buck stops with me, and I trust Laurel, who was his chief of staff at the time. And so he has sort of distanced himself and just said, you know, I did all of this because I thought it was the right thing to do.
Officially regarding this reporting, DeWine's spokesman is saying, okay, we knew that the text was sent out, but we thought it was sent out couple days after, indicating that if he asked for money, he did not receive it directly as a result, but that the money was just coming generously over the course of time from First Energy and not like ask and receive.
Okay. But the timeline of it is the text was sent and then a couple of days later, the money was sent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting, Julie did a great job like laying out the timeline there. House Bill 6 passed, Mike DeWine signed it the day that it hit his desk, and he had previously said that he was supportive of any of measures that kept these two nuclear plants owned by a First Energy subsidiary open. That was the main piece of House Bill 6, though obviously there were lots of other elements, some of which we're still paying for. And so, you know, this was legislation that he was supportive of, and, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg situation.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to recreational marijuana, because it could go on sale later this month, but local governments have the option to say no. So Ohio's law passed by voters in November lets cities decide whether they want to allow cannabis within their borders. And Westerville City Council is expected to vote Tuesday on a 7-month moratorium that would ban recreational cultivation, processing, and sales. And, you know, Laura, what I found interesting about that is, like, nearly 60% of Westerville residents voted to legalize marijuana. But that's what you can do, right? Mm-hmm. You can decide to press pause, and then the people of Westerville could decide to override them, right?
Right. The law that voters passed last November said that a marijuana company could run basically a repeal within 60 days, similar to an alcohol, you know, moratorium. And they can repeal that. So if a marijuana company is eyeing a location in Westerville, and we don't know if they are or not, they could always try to reverse that. For the most part, all of those cities across Ohio who are doing this moratorium, and right now I think we're up to 55, but every time I've written about this, all these like townships, really small places are like, you didn't include me. So it's, you know, it's dozens. And whenever, and also in the Columbus area, Bexley has one. And whenever this happens, it's already cities that don't have medical marijuana. The only city so far that I've found that also has medical marijuana yet is doing a moratorium on recreational is a city called Lakewood near Cleveland. And they already, you know, since they already have medical businesses operating, I think they have at least 2 dispensaries. You could very well see that one get challenged in an election.
Some of this, you know, is built off of various communities' history and how they feel. You know, Westerville, home of the women's temperance movement, and, you know, always
sort of... Yeah, they were a dry city until, like, 2004, which was, like, really surprising to me.
Yes, yes. And in Columbus's Clintonville, or Beachwold, was also, you know, well-known for this. And so sometimes it's just a heritage that comes out, which is like, we're just not going there. We're going to be a little more prudent. And... obviously, people who live there now can change, and history marches on. But some of these local communities are, I guess, weighing the morality of it versus the business benefit. Because under the what we passed in issue two, what Ohio passed last year, you know, they do get some incentives for that, as well as they would get whatever comes from
the excise tax.
Yeah.
We'll have to wait and see. So when it comes to those recreational licenses, though, the Division of Cannabis Control says it received 219 applications from medical operators of all kinds that want that dual license. And they've granted preliminary approval to 8, but they still have to meet some final requirements before they can start operating. So could be just a couple of weeks now.
Yes. Accidentally last week, there was... a company that has grow, process, and dispensary sent out a press release to their, like, people who subscribe to their list, which is a lot of customers, saying, we're open. And so then somebody sent it to me, and I was like, no way. No way. This couldn't have happened so fast. And then, sure enough, like an hour later, they were like, just kidding.
Oops.
So yeah. So we know a bunch of people are ready to hit the gas.
Yeah. So potentially by like July 4th.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a story about a marijuana industry analyst he's in New York, and he looks at the industry, and his projection is July 4th sales is when it'll start.
So fireworks and marijuana. I'm sure there's a joke there, but I just can't think of it right now.
Many things will be lit up.
There you go. There it is.
Thank you.
Give it to Jesse.
So, Jesse, I'm going to make a hard transition here to the death penalty. So, Governor Mike DeWine postponed the death sentences of 3 men last week, pushing their executions from this year into 2027. Now, this is nothing new. This is something he's been doing since he was governor. So, he's just sort of kicking it down to whoever comes next.
Yeah, I think that's it's more of the status quo for the death penalty. There was a push earlier this year, and maybe even the end of last year, to really get the death penalty up and running again. Ohio has not been using lethal injection. The companies that provide the drugs that we use in that cocktail have said that they don't want to sell it to us. And if we do want to buy it, that risks accessing that drug for other more non-death penalty uses. And so that has been the reason why the lethal injection has been held off. There was another method that was like an epoxia situation that was used in a
nitrogen.
Nitrogen, epoxia, thank you. That was used in a different state. And so there was a lot of interest in maybe starting that up in Ohio. There were press conferences. The Attorney General, Dave Yost, was there. And yet that piece of legislation really hasn't been moving swiftly through the Ohio legislature. So time will tell whether there's like an increased push for getting the death penalty up and running. But there has not been an execution under Governor Mike DeWine's tenure.
And there probably won't be, if I was willing to venture a guess. But we'll have to wait and see.
And he has not gone so far as to say he doesn't support the death penalty.
Although a lot of people suspect that's where he stands now.
Right, right. And we have seen, you know, we had a prison director, longtime prison director, Reggie Wilkinson, this was years ago, who once he retired, you know, kind of changed his tune. I mean, we might have had 2, actually, prison directors who did that in Ohio. But it hasn't. And actually, Larry Householder, prior to everything that happened to him, had thought that there was some Republican support building for getting rid of it in our state. And there are bipartisan bills out there that just don't seem to go anywhere.
Let's get an update on the school voucher lawsuit. So Upper Arlington became the latest district to join the lawsuit alleging that Ohio's voucher program, known as EdChoice, violates the state's constitution. And so board members in Upper Arlington split 3-2 on the vote, even after they got a letter from Lieutenant Governor John Husted. So, Laura, why did Husted write a letter to this district in this moment and not the 200 others that have already joined this lawsuit?
Does he live in Upper Arlington? He lives there. Also, he's running for governor. So there's like different ways you can get things done. If you are the lieutenant governor and you call a city council or council person or like a school board person, they're going to call you back. You know, you don't have to send a letter. So the fact that he had this like on the record, I feel like this is all about the gubernatorial primary. He wants people to know that he is for school choice. In Upper Arlington, there were only 11 kids on education or Ed Choice Expansion, which is an income-based voucher. It's based on family income. And then once they took it to the legislature, expanded eligibility for all incomes. If you're like a millionaire, you don't get the full amount of the voucher, but you get a partial amount, but there is no caps on income. Everybody gets a voucher. And once they expanded it, it went to like over 300 kids on the voucher. And I mean, my reporting up in the Cleveland area has shown that a lot of these kids were never in the public school. It wasn't like all of a sudden overnight their family qualifies for, right. You know, they were already in private schools. Now they just qualify for a voucher. So,
yeah, I've seen estimates over like 90% of the kids on Ed Choice have never been to a public school, right. Something like that.
Yeah. Right. And there was even pressure, you know, from some of the private schools to make sure that their existing students made deadlines and things like that, mm-hmm. too, so that they could use this public money.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, you know, obviously the argument against it is, why are you using most money that comes from property taxes in a place like Upper Arlington? Definitely it's property taxes on litigation. And then the argument for it is the state constitution says that the legislature must provide for a common school system of schools, which means public schools. And so when you are increasingly funding these vouchers, I mean, I think 70% of kids still go to regular public schools. And so when you have vouchers increasing every year, you know, there's not infinite resources. Where is this money going to come from to keep those common schools going?
But Vouchers Heard Ohio filed this lawsuit more than 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So where are we in the legal process? I mean, I know the wheels of justice turn incredibly slowly, but
for the last year, they've been fighting over whether Ohio Senate President Matt Huffman should be deposed. That's been the fight for about a year. They're supposed to go to trial, I believe, is it November 1 or November 4? But November, they're going to trial.
So right around election time.
Supposedly, right? Who knows what's going to happen? I mean, because the organization that's kind of like shepherding the lawsuit through, shepherded a lawsuit through in the 90s having to do with how property taxes were funding various school districts, and then poor communities were not being funded very well. It was like overall school equity funding. And that was a almost 10-year lawsuit, I believe. It was more than 10 years, I think. And so, you know, so they're like in it for the long haul.
Yeah, so we're 2 years into the next 10-year period.
We're a fifth in.
Right, and those DeRolf, there were several decisions in the DeRolf suits that, but basically the idea is the same, that, you know, there should be a common system of schools, they should be adequately funded, they should be equitably distributed, and that involved with DeRolf also school buildings as well as, you know, the education system.
Husted said, well, the voucher issue's already been decided at the U.S. Supreme Court level with a case that originated from Cleveland, because our very first voucher system in Ohio was Cleveland.
First in the country, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in like the 90s.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court said it wasn't unconstitutional to have money going to private schools that were like religiously affiliated. However, they're not relitigating the religion issue. They're talking about the money and the constitutional issues around the money.
And so it's not a question of whether you can have vouchers. It's a question how big the program can be.
Yeah. And that's what, I mean, one of the people on the Upper Arlington School Board said, I'm not against school choice. I'm just against not having any parameters around it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, for the people of Columbus, I mean, they're watching the Columbus City Schools dealing with this building issue and, you know, having to close and sell so many buildings. And, you know, this is coming in this same climate. There's something in the state law that says that they have to offer their buildings to charter
schools.
Right,
first refusal, yeah.
Right. And so we're having a real kind of revolution in this area right now.
That was Julie Carr-Smythe, government reporter for the Associated Press. Coming up, whether we're really one step closer to a law mandating Ohio hospitals post their prices. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, and Julie Carr-Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Because I can't let an hour go by without getting into the weeds of something wonky, let's talk about Social Security. So Sherrod Brown has been working for years to eliminate this thing called the WEP, or the Windfall Elimination Provision. Basically, very quickly, what it does is shrink the amount of Social Security a person with a public pension can receive. So if a police officer or a firefighter retires at 40 and then works a private sector job for 20 years, their Social Security from the private job gets cut because they have a public pension. And Brown wants to get rid of this. And he's been working on it for years, Julie, but he seems to have a real sense of urgency about getting it done now.
How interesting.
Can't imagine why.
That Sherrod Brown may be in one of the hottest Senate races in the country this year. He has fought back a couple different Republicans in the last two times he's run, but this year is viewed as pretty rough for a Democrat in the state of Ohio because we have gone red since Sherrod ran last, and Donald Trump won the state by 9 percentage points or so. And so he's running against Bernie Moreno, who's Trump endorsed, and he held this hearing on the WEP issue in Columbus this last week. And I have to say, I mean, it was absolutely packed to the gills. I mean, standing room only, lots of people in uniform. I mean, and he had a bipartisan panel of people talking about it. And between asking them questions, he would sort of make points about things that he had experienced or fought for. So it was a big sort of show for him. I happened to be pulling in a few minutes late and was trying to find a parking space. And as I pulled in and tried to persuade the officer to let me into the thing, He said, well, you know, Sherrod Brown's in there. That's why it's so packed. And I said, well, yeah, like, what do you think? You're going to vote for Sherrod Brown? You think Sherrod can win with the cops and the firefighters and whatever? And he's like, I think Sherrod can win. You know, it might be close, but, you know, this is what he's after, right? He's trying to just sort of get the buzz going with a group that he really wants to see support him in November.
Yeah, J.D. Vance, I'll say, is also a co-sponsor of this bill, so it is bipartisan. And Brown, at that meeting, said he's got 59 Senate sponsors, which is one shy of what he needs to close debate. So who knows? I don't know if it goes anywhere. We'll have to wait and see. And speaking of waiting and seeing, anybody who commutes down U.S. 23 in the morning can know just how long you're waiting to get to where you want to go. Governor Mike DeWine plans to share ODOT's strategy for congestion. And the recommendations come from a study on how to alleviate traffic from Worthington to Waldo and maybe, potentially, fingers crossed, one day, a freeway between Columbus and Toledo. I don't know. As somebody who uses 23 every day, I guess a girl can dream.
Well, you know, there are pros and cons to that, right? Because
the freeway's got to get built somewhere.
My husband and I just went through upstate New York, which had developed a huge system of rest areas that were on off without tolls. So it was a toll road, and these were the only places you could really get on and off unless you got off on some small town. And they have ripped them out since I reported on those getting built 20 years ago, probably because, you know, the local community said, wait a minute, you know, and who knows whether, you know, that kind of a highway is good for the communities up and down 23, which is quite well developed.
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because as Central Ohio continues to grow and grow and grow, there is sort of a question of how do we mitigate the traffic? Do we build an outer belt? I don't know.
Well, we are also bidding for some Amtrak, aren't we? So
yeah.
It's possible we get some public transportation.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not going to hold my breath. I'm not going to hold my breath on that like exit between Polaris and like Sunbury on 71 either. That feels a long way off. Speaking of legislation that's lingered for years and years, the Ohio House passed the Crown Act last week, which would have banned discrimination against natural hair. Laura, Democratic Representative Juanita Brent of Cleveland has introduced this legislation to end hair discrimination 3 times in 6 years. What are the chances of it passing the Senate now?
I don't know. What's the pass the chances of anything passing the Senate? You know, these two chambers aren't really talking because Senate President Matt Huffman wants to become the next House Speaker, and the current House Speaker, Jason Stevens, wants to continue in his job. So because of this, there's an impasse in the chambers between, well, basically every bill almost. I mean, even this capital budget is going to be a, you know, art of negotiation because they have completely different ideas.
Yeah, I don't know. The House also decided to invest $35 million to improve the health of new moms and their babies. This was a priority of House Speaker Jason Stevens, but it had strong supports from both sides of the aisle. The bill has a provision to support doulas, pregnancy, postpartum individuals, children and family in poverty, even money for the Medicaid program and the Head Start program. So it seems like that's something that they can agree on, maybe.
Yeah. I mean,
don't sound so convinced. I mean, they also going to become law.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, yeah, this Crown Act, there's a federal equivalent. I mean, you know, in our society, unfortunately, Black women in particular, you know, get told they can't wear their hair naturally. Some people don't like it even in braids. And, you know, relaxers are not good for, you know, there's a lot of chemicals. And so, and then, you know, sometimes your hair just needs a break from that. And so it seems like this should be a no-brainer. Professional women need to have options for how they wear their hair.
Yeah, and when it comes to maternal mortality and infant mortality, I want to play a cut of Columbus Democrat Latanya Humphrey and Speaker Jason Stevens.
It's still a beautiful, vibrant bill that is going to help babies and children all across the diaspora, from urban communities all the way to Appalachia. And so I'm very proud of the work that we've done with House Bill 7.
When you value life, you want to make sure that you protect it and help in any way you can.
Yeah, because Ohio has a high rate of maternal mortality, right? And an even higher one for women of color and their babies.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad. I mean, there are countries in Central America that have better maternal mortality rates than like Akron and Cleveland. So it's incredibly sad. And the legislature, to their credit, have been trying to chip away at this for years. And then Governor DeWine has had some initiatives and has put some money in it. So slowly, hopefully, we'll start to see a turnaround.
And this isn't... The timing on this isn't coincidental either, necessarily, when you look at this being an election year. One of the big complaints and selling points that Democrats make on the campaign trail in election years is, you know, oh, you know, you guys are all opposed to abortion, but what do you do for living children? That the Republican Party has, you know, if they were really pro-life, that they would want to help children once they're born. And so when you heard Jason Stevens speak there, that's exactly what Republicans want, that talking point this summer as they campaign.
Okay, the moment we've all been waiting for. Let's talk about feral pigs. The House unanimously passed a bill to let people shoot them without a hunting license and require everyone to report feral pig sightings to state officials. So, Jesse, why so much hate for the feral pig?
Yeah, I mean, as Representative Bob Peterson said, this is not Porky Pig. This is not the pig at the fair. These are pretty, like, vicious animals. And there have been some instances in other states where it's really been overrun and they've had to take even more drastic measures. And so last week was just like a really interesting week in the House. There was a lot of these kind of bipartisan, everyone can get along and agree on something bills that were going through. And this was one of them, because no one wants to get run over or have their property or ourselves damaged by a feral pig.
Yeah, I saw in one of the articles that it's estimated feral pigs can do $2.5 billion worth of damage to crops in Ohio. So far more destructive than Porky Pig. Mm-hmm.
And they're mean. And the bill would also make it illegal to feed garbage to feral pigs.
I didn't know that was a thing people did.
Apparently, this is also something I didn't know. You can get a license to feed garbage to feral pigs, which is like gross. But anyway, nobody's got the license, so they're just going to eliminate it in that bill.
I find that really like strange. Do you just like put it out for them? I don't know how that works.
Yeah, I mean, they're...
Send them over to Rumpke and put them, let them on the loose.
Well, I've seen people use goats, right, to clear their brush. Like, instead of, like, mm-hmm. you know, mowing your lawn, you can get goats to come eat it. So, I don't know.
I mean, in Texas, they have been known to maul children. This is not...
No, I know.
This is not something you want. There's, what, 8 counties in Ohio that I've already reported seeing some feral pigs. So, this is not...
They're on the move.
Yeah, this isn't Wilbur from Charlotte's Web, you know.
Or the ones you see at, like, the state fair. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about hospital price transparency. So the Ohio Senate voted last week to make hospitals publish the cost of their services. The bill passed 27-6, but it removed language that would allow patients to submit a complaint to the Ohio Department of Health if hospitals don't comply. And ultimately, this seems to be just another situation where the Senate passed a version, the House has a version, and maybe never the twain shall meet.
Yeah, I mean, they watered it down in the Senate and said that they could just do price estimates, where in the House they said they wanted actual prices for insured people versus non-insured people. And in the House, they had a provision saying that you cannot, if you're not in compliance with this law, you're not allowed to have sick your bill collectors after people who aren't paying their bills.
That would make people comply.
Yeah. And the Senate took that out, and the Ohio Hospital Association and the Ohio Children's Hospital Association, they're happier, obviously, with the Senate's version of the bill.
So, like a lot of things, this General Assembly, the House has an idea, the Senate has an idea, and maybe we'll never get a law.
Which is so interesting, right? Because, you know, they're both super majority Republican. Presumably this could be a moment when they push through sort of the ideal, you know, world that Republicans want, and they have a Republican governor, and even with the governor there, they're not always getting what they want. He's had more vetoes than a lot of governors.
And on bills like this, I mean, I think everyone's had a hospital bill that maybe surprised them, or they didn't know what it was going to be going in. I know, just like had to get a bump removed off my head that was like benign, and I was trying to figure out if it was a certain size, it was going to cost this. If it was less than that, it would cost something else. And so it's just really hard to navigate. So I think it's an idea that probably has bipartisan support and like the average consumer would get behind. But even on things that seemingly could be simple, it gets complex with this particular General Assembly.
And one final thing. So Columbus lawmaker Dontavius Gerrels wants to tell the story of the Randolph Freed People. They are a group of about 400 slaves who were freed by a guy named Randolph Freed and then given land here in Ohio. But the state of Ohio didn't protect them when they tried to enforce that right to the land. And now, nearly 200 years later, Gerrels would like to give them a piece of land that he believes they are long owed. He's scheduled to have a news conference tomorrow, and we'll be talking about it on Wednesday during our Juneteenth coverage here on All Sides. WOSU reporter Ali Vugrinsic also went with him to see the land and their descendants. Her story is live now on WOSU, and I just wanted to give a quick plug for it because I think it's a pretty incredibly interesting and sad story. So that was my quick plug, and then I want to say thank you so much to Jesse Ballmert, state government reporter with the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Hancock with Cleveland.com. Thank you for coming on this morning.
Good to be here.
And Julie Carr Smythe, government and politics reporter for the Associated Press. Thank you.
Happy to be here.
And thanks so much to our producers, Marcus Charleston and Aaron Rabinowitz, our intern producers, Abigail Jump and Kara Carter, and our board operator, Chris Johnston. That'll do it for this hour of All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.